From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. When the New Horizons spacecraft left Earth 9 years ago, we were still calling Pluto a planet. Now, after traveling more than 3 billion miles, the mission is sending back the dwarf planet's first close-ups. We talk with project scientist Hal Weaver at New Horizons Operations Center in Laurel about what we're learning. Then, whose life was more interesting? Marlon Brando, Amy Winehouse, or an African-American transgender prostitute? Find out when Tom Hall speaks with our movie sages Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post. Plus, the local band Hollywood Blanks got together while its members were studying at St. Mary's College in Southern Maryland. Ahead of their performance at Artscape Sunday, we ask about their new album and what influenced them. First news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner. The planet Pluto was discovered in 1930, but until recently, we did not know that much about it. Our knowledge of Pluto has expanded exponentially this week, however, as the New Horizons spacecraft beams a whole bunch of pictures and data 3 billion miles back to Earth. Hal Weaver is project scientist for the mission and joins us from the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel for this update. Good morning, Hal.
Hi, Nathan. Glad to be back.
New Horizons zipped by Pluto on Tuesday at a speed of 30,000 miles an hour, and I understand it's going to take months before we even get all the data that it picked up on its flyby. But even so, we're already learning a lot. Tell us the latest.
Oh, wow. It's been like we've been like kids in a candy shop. It's so much fun seeing the data come in. We are picking out the choicest data sets, and you know, like you said, to get all of it down is going to take about 16 months.
Why is it going to take so long?
3 billion miles away, you know, the small antenna trying to send radio signals all the way back to the Earth at about 2 kilobits per second, 2,000 bits per second.
That's a very slow internet connection.
Yes, that's back in the old days, the modem days. Even though it's very sophisticated equipment, it's the best you can do out of that distance.
One of the neatest things that we know so far is that Pluto could actually be geologically active because the surface we're seeing is relatively new.
Yeah, at least part of the surface, some of the youngest surfaces we've ever seen on a planetary surface, you know, less than about 100 million years old. That sounds like a long time.
Is that younger than Earth?
Oh, yes. Everything formed in the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. So this is like a... taking a snapshot, very recent snapshot.
Earth, of course, is still geologically active. Do we know yet how geology might work on Pluto?
Well, that's the big mystery. There was radioactivity in the interior, decay of radioactive elements heats up the interior. We thought that probably would have dissipated by now, and so that, you know, the surface of Pluto wouldn't have shown such incredible structures. I mean, we've got ice mountains as high as the Rockies. We've got deep valleys bigger than the Grand Canyon, and, you know, ice mountains, you know, made of water ice.
And this is not what you would have expected at all.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's really been a surprise, and it's going to cause us to scratch our heads, go back to the drawing board, and probably, rethink, you know, all of the dwarf planets throughout the solar system. You know, what do they really look like, and what processes are still active?
We have seen some amazing pictures so far. By now, everyone has probably seen the giant white heart-shaped formation on Pluto's surface. I gather we're naming that after the man who discovered Pluto?
That's right. Tombaugh Regio. Clyde Tombaugh is the person who discovered Pluto back in 1930. And his whole family was out at the APL this past week to witness the encounter. And his ashes are actually on the spacecraft, so that was very nice. Clyde glided by Pluto.
What do we know about the Tombaugh Regio so far, the giant heart?
Actually, the heart seems to be divided into two different ventricles, very different colors, and they're, you know, probably different compositions. We're still waiting for the data that really samples the composition of the surface at that fine detail. That'll should be coming in over during the next week, and we'll be able to say more then.
How are we naming the features on Pluto and the ones that we're spotting on Pluto's moons?
Actually, it's quite a complicated process, but the team has been working on it for several months and has been working with NASA and the International Astronomical Union, which is the agency that officially names objects in the solar system. And, you know, we have we follow certain rules. Things in the Pluto system are named after the underworld and death. That doesn't sound too good. So we're trying to have some, you know, variation in that. And Tom Borigio is one of those. We'll propose that.
I understand that a whole bunch of new images are going to be coming out this afternoon at a NASA media briefing. Can you give us a preview?
It's looking at the surface of Pluto and Charon at, you know, roughly 10 times better resolution than the iconic image of Pluto and Charon that we had that were taken about 16 hours out. These are images that were taken closer to the time of when the spacecraft passed closest to Pluto, and the resolution is better. We've had a couple of days to think about what the meaning of the data are. So you'll hear that discussed at 1 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, for the meaning of the data, we'll have to wait just a little bit.
Right.
This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner on the line with Hal Weaver, project scientist for the New Horizons mission, which is sending a trove of information about the dwarf planet Pluto back to Earth. And Hal, when we last talked, I remember you saying a dwarf planet is a planet. In your estimation, Pluto is a planet, right?
Is there any doubt now?
No,
I mean,
but
you look at that iconic view of Pluto that we released on Encounter Day, July the 14th. I mean, that was, to me, it sort of reminded me of the astronauts looking back at the Earth and seeing the whole globe there. Pluto really does look like a planet.
But Pluto is different from the other eight in our solar system. For one thing, it has this weird orbit that takes it inside Neptune's orbit for 20 years or so every cycle. Do we have any idea why that is? Might we find out?
Oh, yeah, sure. It is definitely a member of the Kuiper Belt. That's this new third zone, newly discovered third zone of the solar system. And Pluto is a member of that. I mean, it's one of the largest. In fact, right now it is the king of the Kuiper Belt. We don't know of any Kuiper Belt object that's larger than Pluto, and that's one of the things we've been able to nail down, exactly how big Pluto is.
We actually found out that it's bigger than we thought, didn't we?
A little bit, yeah.
Pluto has five moons, of course, Charon that you mentioned, four others. Tell us about the biggest one, Charon. What are we seeing there? Because we're seeing some neat features there.
Yeah, in fact, we were expecting in the case of Charon to see it littered with craters because, you know, being inactive and just basically recording the history of the bombardment in the Kuiper Belt over the past 4.6 billion years. But what we saw is very different than that. We see ridges and a few craters here and there, but, you know, significant variations in topology over the surface. And, that was quite unexpected.
We're also seeing some neat features there. I think there's one that they're trying to call Cthulhu, isn't it? Some giant dark object?
Oh, yeah. Near the northern pole, there's a giant dark region, and we're puzzling over now where there could potentially be a giant crater that excavated some material, and it looks dark. But really, what we think is probably happening is maybe some of Pluto's atmosphere has leaked over to Charon and condensed onto the northern pole where it's coldest on Charon, and that's the reason why it's different than the rest of Charon.
So it would be a frozen hunk of Plutonian atmosphere.
Potentially.
That's really neat.
Yeah.
We're also looking at those other moons, Nix, Hydra, Styx, Kerberos. Do we have any information on those?
Oh, yeah. We can't leave them out. Both Nix and Hydra have been revealed by New Horizons now. We can actually resolve them. They're not just little pinpoints. We can see that they're roughly 20 miles across. They seem to be tumbling around, maybe spinning very, very fast. They're also very bright, which means that they're almost certainly covered with water ice. And, so they seem to be icy satellites. and highly elongated. They're definitely not planets. You know, there's about a 30%...
They're not spherical.
Right, they're not spherical. About 30% difference between the long axis and the small axis. And, you know, we have some even better observations coming up soon.
Looking forward to that. Of course, New Horizons may be mostly done with Pluto, having passed it on Tuesday, but its mission's not done. It's going to keep on headed out into the Kuiper Belt. Anything we might see there?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the, actually, the very important objective of the mission is to try and fly by one other Kuiper Belt object in a different family of Kuiper Belt object than what Pluto and its satellites are. We've already identified, using Hubble Space Telescope, two potential Kuiper Belt objects that we could reach with the available fuel on board. We'll make a maneuver sometime late in the fall to head us on towards one or the other after NASA approves that. But we also have to submit a proposal to NASA to carry on what was called an extended mission. But everything really seems to be working well after the Pluto flyby. And even though, I mean, we're already almost 2 million miles past Pluto, so we're on our way deeper into the Kuiper Belt, and we're looking forward to some encounters with, you know, another Kuiper Belt object.
How long might the New Horizons spacecraft last?
It could last probably till about 2030 or so. We should have enough power. We can make measurements of the what we call the heliosphere, the charged particle environment, all the way out to, 30 to 50 AU even. We're at 32, 33 now, but all the way out to 50 AU over the next, decade. But we are also we hope to target one of those small Kuiper Belt objects.
So lots of great data, hopefully, to come. There is another dwarf planet in our solar system, about the same size as Pluto, a planet called Eris, about three times farther away. Are we ever going to explore that one?
That would be wonderful if we could, but the problem is these missions, especially to the outer solar system, they take a long time. I mean, New Horizons spacecraft was we left the Earth faster than any other spacecraft, and it's still, and we got a gravity boost from Jupiter that cut 3 years off the travel time, and it still took us 9.5 years. And so, as you said, Eris is even farther away. It's going to take a long time, and there's nothing on the books right now. It takes about 15 to 20 years for these big missions to go from the idea, the concept, to the to the launch, and then another 10 to 15 years to get there. So I don't think it's going to be in my lifetime, unfortunately.
Well, thankfully, there's going to be a lot to discover about Pluto in the months and years to come. I got one final question for you. When are you going to get some sleep?
Yeah, it's been a busy last couple of months, but this is what we came here for. All of us are charged up. The adrenaline is flowing, and we're having a great time.
Hal Weaver is a scientist at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laro, and we'll be busy sifting through the data the New Horizons spacecraft is sending back to Earth for quite a while. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nathan.
We've got more information about the mission on our website. That's WYPR.org/Maryland Morning, and there'll be more information coming out later this afternoon from NASA. I'm Nathan Sterner. Stay tuned to your public radio.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And good morning, everybody. It's Artscape Weekend. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning, and it's time for our monthly Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. So, Nathan, you going to Artscape this weekend?
I might.
Good. Well, then I'm going to upgrade.
It's going to be hot.
It is going to be hot, but I'm going to upgrade my prediction for Artscape. And I was going to go with Artscape. I was certain it was going to be moderately festive. Now, knowing that you're going to go, I'm going to go with highly festive.
For highly some. Festive. For some, perhaps.
Well, for you, indeed. All
right. For me, indeed. Yes.
And, the Baltimore Office of Promotion of the Arts says that Artscape is the largest free arts festival in the known universe. However, I bet they're shaking in their boots because Pluto, we haven't gotten all of the pictures back from Pluto. And they could find that there's a bigger arts festival on Pluto. You just never know.
It would be a very cold one, though.
It would be.
It wouldn't be nearly as warm.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty warm this weekend. All right. Well, Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival, not the Plutonian Film Festival, and Ann Hornaday from the Washington Post are here. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning.
You guys psyched about Artscape?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Of course.
You got to be psyched.
It's going to be a hot one.
It's going to be a hot one. Going to be a hot one. So there's a bunch of movies in case, you know, you're not watching the Orioles tonight or going to Artscape to see George Clinton. I like George Clinton.
Who doesn't?
I know. So everything he wears, everything he plays, everything he sings.
He's the master.
He is the master. Just love him. But, you know, we have actually even more suggestions of how to get culturally enriched this weekend. And
there are ways.
So there are ways. One of them is to go see a movie called Tangerine, directed by Sean Baker. This is about a prostitute and her best friend, and they go out to L.A., and they're taking revenge on a previous boyfriend/pimp, I guess. Huh? So what do you think, Ann?
Yeah, it's just for the family.
Yet another family rom-com.
You really teed it up, Tom. Thanks a lot. Now, this is an absolutely charming little bagatelle. That was the kind of novelty of it. There's a couple of novelty items about it. One is that it was filmed entirely on iPhones, which is, you know, an arresting fact about it. And but it looks fantastic. I mean, you think it's going to be that kind of garden hose, you know, restless camera, but it's actually visually very elegant. And Sean Baker follows these two characters who are both transgender, and through this kind of misbegotten neighborhood in West Hollywood that's known for its hustlers and its kind of, you know, lowlife, sleazy underbelly. And they have this kind of spontaneous, affectionate humor between them that just is, I found, very beguiling. They're both, you know, he found them in real life. They're both denizens of that neighborhood. They're not denizens of that life, but they know that life very well just from being around it so much. So they kind of lead us and the filmmaker through this kind of white underbelly of a world that is by turns appalling and funny and ultimately really touching.
Yeah, cool. And filmed on iPhones, Jen. Yeah. I mean, is this, what's the motivation here? Is it just cheaper, or is it a gimmick, or how
yeah, work? I don't think it's a gimmick. He started because of budget, but he found that in this neighborhood, and this was really an organically evolved story. He had this sort of notion. He went into the neighborhood. He went to this shop, which is sort of the, as Ann called it, the 21 Club of this neighborhood, called Donut Time. And he started hanging around and getting to know transgender people from that neighborhood, and then went to a center there. And the one of the stars actually helped him evolve the story. So the iPhones he found with special lenses that had just been designed by this group called Moondog, and that they gave him, it allowed him to really shoot with nobody thought a film was being made. So he thought it was much easier for the non-actors, although James Ransom from The Wire is in it. I mean, there are some actors in it, but the lead characters and most of the people you see are not professional actors.
And so maybe the sets didn't look like a set. Were there lights?
It was all shot on location. Yeah, uh-huh.
Natural light.
And yeah, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And he used a lot. It wasn't just iPhones. I mean, SoundCloud provided most of the soundtrack. He cast off of Vines. It's really it is not being gimmicky at all. It's an expression of all this new filmmaking that we're all experiencing to some degree.
And it reminds me, I think last time we were here, we talked about a movie called Heaven Knows What, which is about a junkie in New York. And it has that same kind of energy and that closely observed energy of a subculture that's usually invisible or marginalized. And I think I like this one better just because I think it has a more expansive, optimistic, exuberant view of just human friendship and possibility, and it's very winning.
Sounds like mine. Tangerine. Mm-hmm. All right. There's another one here that Jed, you had at the festival called Best of Enemies, directed by Morgan Neville and Robert Gordon. This is a documentary, and it's about these legendary debates on television between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley back in the day, 1968, I guess.
Yeah, this is another...
I heard a lot of great things about this movie. I wasn't able to see it at the festival.
Yeah, this is another subculture. And these two guys were sort of stunningly, I mean, looking back on it as you watch this film, you sort of can't believe what celebrities they were, because they're effete, intellectual, on opposite sides of the political spectrum, and there's a real personal tension all through this story, used very skillfully by Gore Vidal, I would say. As you see, I don't want to do too much spoiling, but as a little time capsule of media in 1968. And the fascination of where we were in political discourse in 1968, it's unbelievably entertaining and made by one of the guys who did 20 Feet from Stardom, so very skilled filmmaking, really great.
And there was real animus between these two guys.
And it's just, you know, it kind of reminds me for people who saw Life Itself about Roger Ebert, it's similar to that animus between Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, where you're kind of shocked that these two mature, grown-up men could be so kind of childish in terms of their emotional relationship with each other. But it's the stakes are such that it's ABC brought them on because they were last in the ratings. They were just in the dumper in terms of ratings for these political conventions, and they were looking for something. And like, who would think that a ratings bonanza would be to put these, as Jed said, these two effete, verbose intellectuals? It's like, oh, there's the ticket. You know, that'll bring in the viewers. But I don't want to spoil. But that's going on. So you're looking at that piece of media culture, and then you're also seeing this anticipation of where we are now with the food fight, 24/7 cable TV.
Sure.
You know, Yell Fest. I mean, this is where it
and in
it
between
began.
You had Saturday Night Live. You know, Jane, you ignorant
True.
Slut. And that's
exactly right. Yeah. But it just presages all of that. And then in the meantime, it just turns into this incredibly poignant portrait of both guys.
Yep.
And what this, you know, these debates did to them personally. And just it really, they left lasting scars on both gentlemen. And it's just a fascinating, deeply layered meditation on all of that.
All right. Best of Enemies, mm-hmm. about Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley. There's another documentary about Marlon Brando. It's called Listen to Me, Marlon. This sounds like an amazing piece as well.
I think any archival footage of Marlon Brando doing anything is going to be pretty fascinating. And I don't think this is a perfect film by any stretch, but literally watching him in every frame of this film is stunning, but some of it clips from his films.
And
which
and
are
this
all
is a chronological
stunning.
Thing. We start, you know, with Little Marlon and get to old.
Yeah, pretty
Marlon.
Much. It's mostly career stuff. The most revelatory thing to me, just because I didn't know anything about it, is apparently he taped himself doing psychological sessions with himself. I mean, he became the on tape. He became the shrink for himself.
He was self-shrinking himself.
Yes,
that's right.
And you see, I mean, there's quite a bit of that here, which is all sort of fascinating because it's this great actor analyzing himself being a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
Literally the actor's studio.
And those tapes sort of are the spine of the film. So it's really an audio, it's a collage, you know, it's an audio collage. And for the most part, I think those tapes sort of form the major audio aural part. And then it's overlaid with images. So it's just a really interesting one. It played at AFI Docs this summer, and you know, I think we are in, most people agree we're in a golden age of documentary film. I do think that formally I'm seeing a lot of reversion to certain structural tropes. You know, the talking heads and archival footage, the, you know, the quirky central character and, you know, the handheld camera. And this is one of these rare films that does something formally that we don't often see.
Because there's,
you know,
no talking heads in this, right?
Exactly. It's just purely archival footage kind of overlaid onto this verbal material that aren't always literally lining up necessarily. So I just like it when filmmakers take a chance like that and try to sort of mix it up and do something a little bit different.
Cool. On 88.1, if you've just joined us, you're listening to the monthly Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival is here, as well as Anne Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. So Jed, there's another one called, a movie called The End of the Tour, and you have a very personal relationship with one of the guys involved in this movie.
Yeah, just the writer is a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright named Donald Margulies. And years ago, I was placed in a public high school in New York City, John Dewey High School, to do a theatrical piece with a bunch of high school students. And Donald was one of those students.
Uh-huh.
And
So he's gone on to bigger and better things. Mm-hmm. Terrific.
Yep.
Starts with you.
Thanks to you. You know,
yeah, right. Studied at the feet of the
You're
master.
You're welcome, Don Margulies.
There you go. This is a movie that stars Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg, and it's about a five-day interview between a reporter for Rolling Stone and David Foster Wallace right after the publication of his big epic novel, Infinite Jest, which everything about that novel was, you know, larger than life. Everything about him, in a way, you know, David Foster Wallace is larger than life. So the movie lives up to the subject.
I think it really works. I think it's the most improbable premise for a movie. And I think actually the two actors who I like, both of them, but in these roles seem improbable. And the whole thing really works. I mean, it's a fascinating portrayal of a writer, but not a famous novelist, but who would aspire to be that, spending time with this very famous, big, as you said, bigger than life novelist. And the two of them, you know, very wary of each other, some out of jealousy, some out of just worrying about exposure and, you know, lack of privacy and that kind of stuff. And that's the film. I mean, so you get to see this, the sort of the world of celebrity writers viewed from a writer's viewpoint. And I think it's really compelling and a terrific film.
Yeah. Let's talk about another documentary, Anne, the one about Amy Winehouse, mm-hmm. Which has been, as a movie, as a film, it's been highly applauded and, you know, very well received. Miss Winehouse, of course, very tragic story, very gifted young woman who died of a heroin overdose, had a drug addiction. But this is all, again, this is a lot of archival footage and mm-hmm. sort of personal stuff from her, you know, family movies, that kind of thing.
Yeah, this was, this made its premiere at Cannes, and it was one of the big, in an otherwise kind of ho-hum Cannes this year. It was really a standout. And it's become a huge hit, especially in the UK, and it's doing very well here, too. I mean, it's really, I think it kind of qualifies as one of the summer, you know, summer's become a really good time to open a documentary just in terms of counter-programming to all the comic book movies, and so I think it's finding its, mm-hmm. it's really finding its perch within that. It's made by the same guy who did this wonderful documentary called Senna about a Formula One race car driver. Mm-hmm. And he's just, you know, I said before that I'm a little bored with these structural tropes, but this is an instance where that same kind of conventional structure really works in terms of using archival footage and talking heads to create a brand new vision of someone we thought we knew. I mean, he really, for one thing, he has access to her old home movies as a mm-hmm. young girl. So it opens with you hearing her kind of just toss off little ditties with her friends, and you are stunned by
at the age of 14.
Exactly, yeah. At this talent that's just bursting from this girl, and it's completely ungoverned and ungovernable. And then we trace the career, which, again, we think we know. But I think he really, one of the great values of this film is that he restores her and rescues her and puts her in her rightful place as a great jazz artist. Yeah. I mean, you really do see her as just a fabulous interpreter of jazz music.
The other thing I think that it does beautifully that I've never seen portrayed as well on film is this tsunami that celebrity can be and how overwhelming it can be for certain people. You see her fragility as a young person, and as this thing hits,
caught up with her quickly.
Oh, boy.
And clearly it was more than she could take.
And she was ambitious. I mean, she really, her art was very, very important to her. So you see her pursue it, but it outruns her, and you see what it does to her and the people around her, and it's horrifying to watch in that sense, but also fascinating. And I think it's something anybody who is thinking about a career in entertainment, film, music, whatever, should see this, because it's something to learn from.
Well, and also I think it really indicts the audience in terms of our hunger for the train wreck narrative.
Yeah.
And it captures that
because it ain't the first train wreck in rock music. That's
exactly.
For sure.
Yeah. And it kind of the glee with which, you know, talk show hosts, and she just became such a punchline, and it is just so queasy to look back on that and think, oh, did I laugh at that joke, or did I buy that magazine? And
yeah, so Amy
and it's not done in any kind of polemical way. I mean, it's a very subtle, very elegant, nuanced
really
film.
Terrific.
Yeah, the film is called Amy, and I want to ask you about another Amy Schumer.
Oh, yes.
Who is really having...
In Trainwreck.
Yeah, she is in a train wreck.
That's right.
That's the name of her new movie. Which
and she's anything but.
Yeah, she's written this movie, and Judd Judd Apatow, her good buddy from way back, is directing it. Mm-hmm. This is another hit out of the park here. I'm a huge fan of Amy Schumer. I think her show is hysterical.
It's
and
pretty
the social commentary that she has is just, you know, unlike stuff that anybody else is doing.
Yeah, I mean, she is somebody who has found her moment, and her moment has found her, and they're getting along famously together. And I really liked the movie with Judd Apatow. He has a tendency he needs a strong editor, and that's true of this film too. It kind of sags, it digresses, it's baggy, it's a little bit ungainly, in its form, but. Other than that, I mean, within it are countless delights.
Yeah.
Schumer's great. Bill Hader plays her love interest, who is an absolute wonder. I mean, he's really a revelation.
Yeah.
And who knew? LeBron James. I mean,
he
shows up, and not even a cameo. I mean, he's like a bona fide supporting role as the best friend, and he's delightful. It doesn't necessarily have, I don't think, the social edge that her show does, just because her show can be more nimble. But it's good.
All right, Amy, and we will talk about Tig Notaro's movie the next time you're here, Jeff.
Okay, it starts on Netflix today.
Yeah, because another comic who's also having a moment. All right, great to see you both. Thank you so much.
Thank
enjoy
you.
Artscape.
Thank you.
Artscape takes off in about an hour and 20 minutes on 88.1. You can come to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, for a complete schedule. We're coming up after the news and a little break. We're going to hear from a band that's appearing at Artscape. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. In about an hour and 15 minutes, the 34th edition of Artscape begins here in Baltimore. One of the bands that will be featured on the Sound Off Live stage is the Baltimore indie rock quartet Hollywood Blanks. Their sound is drenched in synth tones, sonorous drums, and gritty electric guitar. Since forming back in 2012, their music has dipped into genres like psych rock, punk, even country. The band's first full-length album is called Projections, which will be released next month. They'll perform at Artscape Sunday at 4 o'clock. Three of the members of Hollywood Blanks are Rich Colm, Jimmy O'Keefe, and Trevor Shipley. They spoke recently with our intern, Christy Forrest.
I'm Jimmy. I play the guitar, and I guess I'm the chief songwriter and vocalist.
My name is Trevor. I do keyboards and lead guitar. I also sing, do harmonies, and lead vocals on a few songs.
My name is Rich. I play the bass guitar, and yeah, I sing as well.
So we all met in college at St. Mary's in Southern Maryland. We would play with each other informally at house parties and bonfires and things like that.
A lot of the times you'd be out around a fire in the woods or down by the shore. And it was really, you know, it was suitable for acoustic guitar, for any acoustic instruments. And like, you know, it kind of breeds a sort of folk feel. And once we all started getting together in Baltimore City, like just sort of naturally the sound grew into more edgy, more dark, maybe more aggressive, louder. Jimmy is like the uncanny ability to come up with like really good, compelling lyrics, which as a songwriter myself, that's something I'm like really jealous about.
In witches to say, you and now we both are servants, but the fighting has been worth it, all above the minimum wage. And she wants to go to Vegas for vacation.
It did take a while before things started to gel in a way that, you know, we were really happy with.
It's definitely something that I feel like we play off of as well. Having a lot of different styles playing into what we're doing like can get maybe confusing to talk about when people ask us, like, what kind of music do you play? It's the, you know, age-old question that, like, I always dread because I'm just, I don't know, rock and roll, that sounds lame, but, you know, like, it's something else than that, and we accomplish that by, like, bringing in a lot of different things into the same set. We have a lot of songs. Like, I remember, like, we wrote them all out. It's like 40 songs, original songs that we've played live before. And we don't play all of them regularly, but we do custom tailor all of our sets. Like, every time we play a show, we're like, all right, well, who's going before us? What do they sound like? Who's going to be there, and what do they want to hear? And I do really like that.
I think for Artscape, all the other bands playing, that's a determining factor on, like, what people are going to hear, what it's going to sound like to them. You know, what we're going to put up on stage is probably mostly influenced by the fact that there's a giant festival going on around us, you know? There's crazy art everywhere.
I definitely think we all take a lot of inspiration from the city, our surroundings, the scene that we're a part of, which is, like, super supportive of us and has all sorts of cool things going on. And it's really just, I feel actually pretty blessed to be a part of it.
Well, them good Christian boys don't make love on their back. Sit down on their knees, covering their track. God help the one who decides to look up. Sees that hole riding high, making love to his love. And me, I don't know what the shushing's about. I'm going to where all the baritones shout.
The Hollywood Blanks, their new album is called Projections. It drops August 1st. They'll perform at Artscape Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Artscape begins this morning at 11 o'clock. We'll have a link to all of the events at Artscape on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks to our intern, Christy Forrest, for producing this segment. We're looking for other Maryland bands to profile here on Maryland Morning. If you've got a favorite act you'd like more folks to know about, drop us an email at mdmorning@wipr.org. That's it for us today. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.
Come on. Step on down.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore. The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
Wait, Tom, something's not right.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
Back there, this.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
But it won't be for long. Today is Matt Purdy's final day as Maryland Morning's senior producer.
He's moving to Boston. He's got a new job covering technology, business, and innovation at WGBH Public Radio.
How can he walk out on us like this? He had all these nifty experiences on Maryland Morning, like a year ago when he tested what it would be like to skip food and subsist on a gritty concoction called People Chow 3.0.1, meal after meal after meal.
I think you begin to realize all the different things that food does for us, just on a sensory level. So I started on a Monday, like I said. I had that first shake in the morning, second at lunch. I was doing pretty good. And then dinner time rolled around, and I had to have another shake, the same exact taste, same consistency, everything. The next day, when I got up and I had to have that shake again, it's just like, I wanted something solid. I wanted something that tasted different. I broke down and I had a carrot after work on Wednesday, and I crunched into this carrot, and it was a revelatory carrot. Mm-hmm. It was just like the crunch of and sort of chewing something was, it was like being in a sensory deprivation chamber for like a couple days and not seeing colors or tasting anything, and then everything just explodes when you actually, you know, have food again.
Yeah, I remember that. I was glad it was him and not me.
Matt also got a chance to get outdoors from time to time, like back in 2012 when we stomped around the Jug Bay Wetland Sanctuary with Sam Droege during the Audubon Society's Christmas bird count.
There was a bird. What's that?
Oh my God.
What was that?
You know, that might have been a bittern. Shoot. What did it look like? Describe it, Matt.
Brown. I don't know.
What did its head look like?
I didn't see it. He's flying the other direction.
Damn. See, that's a good bird. We've only had bitterns on relatively few counts.
Is there any way we can maybe get him to fly?
Yes, Matt, run out there and flush it again.
We should have known Matt was looking for something different when he freelanced a report for The Signal about Johns Hopkins hosting the World Cup of Muggle Quidditch, a sport straight out of Harry Potter.
The real question, after we're done laughing, is
whether this is something we should make fun of. Well, it probably is, but it's also actually kind of inspiring. I mean, isn't this the kind of unabashed, make-up-your-own-rules fun that we were all so good at when we were kids? And where did that even go? And who can blame anyone for wanting to hold on to that, at least for a little while?
Okay, but don't make Matt sound like some aimless wisp. He was an important part of our team that earned a prestigious Alfred I. DuPont Award last year for our series about inequality in the Baltimore region, The Lines Between Us.
Like most of what good producers do, the ways Matt made us better did not always have his name on it. He reported and organized and brainstormed and edited, and with it all made Maryland Morning much more valuable to our listeners than it would have been without him.
Matt came to us with a background in theater and a natural gift for getting to the heart of each story he produced. We will miss his good humor, strong leadership, and gentle touch. Boston is lucky to have him.
As far as we're concerned, Matt Purdy leaving Baltimore is this sad day in Maryland history.
It's Maryland Morning. We'll be back Monday. Have a great weekend.